Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. Oh, there you have it. That is such incredible music from a Broadway musical playing now at the Cadillac Palace Theater called Come From Away. If you have not seen it, it is a must-see. I'm Paul Lisnick. Welcome to Behind the Curtain, everybody. We're going to open up a very busy show with one of the stars of Come From Away. He's so well known in Chicago. I've seen him in so many incredible productions, and so happy he's available to join me to talk about this amazing musical. He is James Earl Jones II. And James, good to talk to you again.
Oh, good to be here. Thank you very much, Paul.
So Come From Away, you know, if somebody hasn't heard of it, they ask me what it's like, and I almost get a kick out of saying, well, it's a musical about 9/11, you know, and then they give you this look. But then I sort of say, no, you let me explain. But why don't you explain for folks who can't imagine getting wrapped up in a musical about 9/11? Tell them what this is actually about.
Sure. So when 9/11 happened, all the planes were grounded by the FAA, and nothing was allowed into the states. And so what happened was all these planes were diverted to various places throughout the world, and 38 planes with 7,000 passengers were diverted to a tiny town of only 9,000 called Gander, Newfoundland, in the northern east tip of Canada. And although these people didn't have to do anything, they got all of the passengers off of the plane, many of whom couldn't even speak English, gave them food, water, shelter, clothing, ways to reach their loved ones wherever they were in the world, and took care of them for 5 days, got them back on the plane, then safely to their destinations, and never asked for a thank you, never asked for anything more. But it's essentially a story about the best of humanity while we were dealing with the worst of humanity.
That you put it beautifully, and I have to say, when I walked out, it made me just want to become a Canadian. I mean, when you see how they treated us, it's an absolutely amazing feeling. But here's the thing, for folks who think, oh, this is just a downer, it's incredibly sad, it is based on a very sad and tragic event, but the show itself, it's uplifting, it's funny. You have some, I'm not going to give them away, but you have some comedy moments that bring the house down.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I think that the great part about this show, and as it was brilliantly written by David Hein and Irene Sankoff, the married couple who wrote this, and Chris Ashley who directed it, was that it moves in a way that there are certainly some sad moments because you can't tell a story surrounding the events of 9/11 without touching on some of the events that actually happened in New York. However, we are trying to show you a better moment in that time, a time when people were comforted and made to feel better, and eventually getting to a place where they found themselves a little less tense. I mean, obviously the event that happened set everyone off in such a way that there's really no way to remove that feeling completely. But I think that when we show you some of the more upbeat moments, it allows you an opportunity to see a different side, because nobody saw that side, right? People only saw the worst moments. They were focusing so much on what was going on in the States, as opposed to more happier moments of people trying to rally together to show acts of kindness and acceptance and love. And it really is just, it's a beautiful story, and it is, it does have funny moments, because, I mean, honestly, and I say this with as much sensitivity as I can, when you go to a funeral, you go to a funeral, and sometimes someone comes up and they speak about the person who has passed away, and you have a funny story to tell, you know, and it's like, and people in the audience, people who are there at the funeral, may laugh because they're like, I remember that about him or her. I remember those good moments, right? Like everything isn't somber. And that's what this show essentially is. It's like, there are certainly sad moments, somber moments, frightening moments, moments of anxiety, to be sure, but there are also good moments shared between these people, shared between these, the community, the Come From Away, and the people from Gander. And that is what we try to focus on most.
And now, I first saw the show on Broadway in New York, and at that time, and for anybody else I knew that saw the show in those opening weeks and months, there was always, amazingly, somebody from Gander in the audience. They were when I was there. They bring flags. They were so proud to be part of this. Is that true at all in Chicago? I'm just curious. Do you get Gander folks showing up, or was that a New York thing?
No. Listen, on tour completely, as well as Chicago, we always have people who are either from Gander, from Newfoundland, or are a direct descendant. It is actually quite amazing and I think that that's just kind of like opened up for us, right? Where like we are doing the show and all of a sudden we're like, wow, so many people from this tiny community, so many people from this tiny town, in some way, shape, form, or fashion, are associated with others within the state. Have come from Gander, Newfoundland, and now living in the States. It's actually quite remarkable that we have not been to a single city, and we've been now to about 26 cities. There hasn't been a single city where someone hasn't said, I'm from Newfoundland. My grandfather's from Newfoundland. My mother or father from Newfoundland. You know, like, it's amazing.
I don't doubt it. I have to tell you as well that the opening night, and I'm sure every night, people could not get on their feet fast enough with a stand. You know, oftentimes the end of a show, you get a standing ovation at Broadway or Broadway Chicago, but it kind of builds over time. Not this show. People were on their feet. That curtain wasn't down, and these people were on their feet and just screaming, because as an ensemble cast, you are amazing, and we should make the point, every one of you, I mean, I can sort of say that you play the character Bob. That's not fair to you, because you guys all play so many different characters, switching at a moment's notice. The audience always knows who you are at any moment.
Yeah, so we were performing. I did a pre-show Q&A in Pittsburgh at the Benedum, and a woman asked me about my various characters, and she said, "Now, am I going to know the difference? Will I see the difference?" And I was like, yes, you will. And that is, it's kind of amazing how the journey goes through the show, where like there are people that think that, oh, I'm not going to tell that this is a different character. But our costume design by Tony Leslie James, it's so brilliant that there are very simple items, but like the audience easily goes on that journey, and they immediately are like, oh, that's a different person. Got a different hat, got a different scarf, got a different jacket. That's a different person. And obviously the actors themselves I think everyone does an amazing job of characterizing themselves in a very specific way for each of those characters that allow people to more easily go on that journey. And I think the entire creative team, I mean, obviously Chris Ashley won the Tony, but the entire creative team, Danny Goldstein, the associate director, and Kelly Devine, our choreographer, Richard Hines, our associate choreographer, like we all put in this time and this effort to tell this story and take you on this journey. And everyone has completely on board each and every night. In San Francisco, I was talking to an usher who said, I literally timed it to see how fast everyone jumped up. And that's actually how it is. And I think that they're not just jumping up because we did a good job. They're jumping up because we told a great message. The band is awesome. We have a person. They're awesome. And they're jumping up because they're jumping up for the feeling that it gives them, the feeling of acceptance, the feeling of love. It is cathartic. It is healing. And that's part of why people jump up so fast.
You know, that reference, the Broadway folks use part of my review in the ads to sell tickets. And, of course, they use Chris Jones of the Tribune. Chris Jones wrote something, and I'm going to test it out on you. Because I guess when I was on Broadway, Chris, he doesn't do stars at Broadway shows, but his comment for Chicago was he is upping the review to 4 stars because it seems that even he gets better the overall power of this thing. But here's what he said, and I'm going to test it on you. Look, I've seen you perform, you know, in Porgy and Bess. I've seen you at Torchlight and Goodman. I've seen you all over the place, Looking Glass, Writers. You're amazing. But Chris Jones says, it appears as though the cast members of this show seem to get that they're doing something bigger than they ordinarily do on a stage. Is he right?
Absolutely. I think that there is never a time where I can't give a great deal of kudos and respect to Chicago theater, because I'm a Chicago actor and I understand our work ethic. I understand that we are about the work. I understand that we are grit and that we are blue collar, and we don't need a lot of glitz and we don't need a lot of glam. And I think that this show isn't glitzy and it's not glamorous, right? It's 12 actors, at 8-piece band on stage, 12 chairs, 3 tables, and everything else is just, it's the story, right? Like, we get out of the way and just tell the story. We do get that there is a bigger deal, a bigger purpose, a bigger message, and we work as an ensemble in the same way that the people of Gander worked as an ensemble for 5 days straight, which is kind of the mindset of why Chris was saying, you know what, let's just do this show, 100 minutes, go. We won't take a break. They didn't take a break. Let's tell this story. And we get out of the way and understand that, like, when we tell this message, it is something bigger than all of us. But to be clear, like, we also understand that this show, for each and every one of us, is a 100-minute trust fall, right? Like, we start the show, and we just go and hope that everything works out. We support one another in the moment. We think fast. We stay focused. And we do what's necessary so that people walk away knowing as much about this show, about these people, about this community, and about what they try to emulate and hopefully carry that message throughout the world.
There couldn't be anybody better to relate the message and import of this show, and certainly in Chicago, than you. I can't let you go without clarifying. People hear that beautiful, deep voice of yours. It sounds a bit like Mufasa. It sounds like the guy on CNN. Your name is James Earl Jones II. It must be. It has to be. But let's disappoint everybody. Tell me about what your relationship is to the other James Earl Jones.
All right. So the older actor is a cousin. I am not his son. I'm not his grandson. I'm incidentally named after my father, which is why I'm just a second, not named after the older actor. But we have met, and he has shared some sage advice, and he's an amazing, amazing man.
and he has in you an amazing cousin. I encourage everybody. I mean, I promote a lot of Broadway shows, but I can't tell people enough to go see Come From Away at the Cadillac Palace Theater through August 18th. You will regret missing this show if you don't see it. The incredible performance of the entire cast, and by the way, give my best to Harder Klingman, another great Chicago actor in this cast, but James Earl Jones II, you are amazing in the show. You just bring a smile and a tear as I watch you throughout. Congratulations. Break legs every night. So glad you're in Chicago, where you're home for Come From Away as you continue the tour. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Paul. Thank you.
All right. Well, that is the beautiful voice of Jeremiah Alsop and other cast members in the very fun show, musical, as you can guess, going on over at Theater Wit. It is called Head Over Heels. It was on Broadway, and then I turned around, and it was in Chicago. How does that happen so fast? It features the songs of the Go-Go's, and it is the creation of incredible people like Jeff Witte, folks who did shows like Avenue Q, Spring Awakening, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, and it is here in Chicago. It stars Jeremiah Alsop as Musidorus, my friend Frankie Leo Bennett as Basilius, the noble and grand king, and co-directed and producing artistic director of Derek Von Barum. Gentlemen, welcome to all of you. I appreciate you joining me.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Paul.
All right. Jeremiah, I'm going to start with you to fill listeners in to exactly what Head Over Heels. If you love the Go-Go's, you're going to love this. But, of course, there is plot to this. So what's Head Over Heels all about?
Oh, sure. So we are in the kingdom of Arcadia. Everyone follows this famous beat. It's kind of what holds everyone together and what has unified this kingdom for forever. And things start to get a little stale around there. People start to fall into more regulatory roles, and the king becomes more strict with that. So there is an oracle, Pythio, that decides things need to change and stir some things up, and it turns into a whole lovely time about mistaken identity and finding your true self, being open about that, and really acceptance in the end.
And Frankie, you've got that classic, you know, every show has to have that sort of king figure, that flawed king figure in there. And you're just, I just love everything I've seen you perform in. But your role here, you can't exactly say you're faithful to your wife, but talk about the role of the king.
Sure. So Basilius, I liken him to if National Lampoon's Vacation was written by Shakespeare. He's your typical dad who still thinks he's cool. And once he realizes that he's not the cool one anymore, it really gets to him. And then I end up falling in love with, which is very easy on and off stage, falling in love with Jeremiah and Musidorus, which, you know, a traditional comedy of errors tale there is that his journey out of his ignorant masculinity is something that Frankie's never had to deal with. But then playing it as Basilius is equally fun, but just as educational.
I love it. And Derek, you and I have talked before about other productions you've directed here. You've been working with Elizabeth Swanson on this one. First of all, answer the question. How did we get this thing to Chicago so fast after Broadway? And then talk about the fact that the show is done in this incredibly intimate environment, like your typical Coke Candy production, so intimate and wonderful.
Yeah, I think the Broadway Licensing, who owns Head Over Heels, was very smart in that. I think even though it didn't catch on in terms of longevity in New York City, I think what they found is the people who fell in love with the show kept coming back to see it again and again. And so I think they were really smart in just making sure the party kept going, that the beat didn't die, as we say in the show. We're the first of I want to say, like, a dozen or so productions happening across the country all the summer. So, you know, they closed down Broadway on mid-January, and we were able to open just about 6 months after. So a really, really quick turnaround. But I think they were super smart in doing that. And then for us, I think when the opportunity for the show came around, Cokandy just sort of jumped on it because we knew we had a summer spot at Theater Wit and wanted to do something fun, which Head Over Heels is, but also something that had a really great message. And I think that's one of the strengths of the show is that if you just want some light summer shows, you know, dance and hear music and have a good time, good evening of theater, there's definitely that. But we've also found audiences really being drawn to some of the deeper messages in the show. So there's a little bit of something for everybody, which we want.
And, you know, Frankie, I'm going to come to you on this because the show breaks through that fourth wall from time to time. And there's nobody for me who seems to have more fun with that than you in terms of kind of reaching through and reaching over. But that's got to be a lot of fun for you. It's almost a wink and a nod to the audience as we're watching this unfold.
Yeah, the piece does such a beautiful job of trusting the audience. It's a lot of verse work. It's a lot of complicated, beautiful text. And I've always found that if you trust the audience to listen to you, they will listen to you. And it's a no better role than the king that I get to just pretend that everyone there is my subjects and they have to listen to me. And then I get to kind of just get away with murder in their show of just being like, well, you're at my mercy for another hour or so listen up. But at the same time, I think it's that honesty that it's just like, we have a very beautiful, important, very poignant story that I have to tell you. And I want to make sure that I'm listening to you responding and that you're listening to me tell you what I think the show is about. And so it's a beautiful relationship I get to have on stage, but the audience really fills in that last chunk for us.
Jeremiah, and talk about working with this ensemble. You know, it's sort of interesting. There's a bit of naivete about your character, just wants to be happy, kind of moves through things, almost as though things happen to you. But your interaction with the ensemble all the way through is just so beautiful to watch. Many of the members just, you know, dance and sing. That's their primary role, but it really plays so well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Derek and Elizabeth and Cokandy in general did such a good job at casting not only talented people, but good people. So from the first day that I was able to be in the room with everyone, there was this feeling of being safe. And that's, I think, as an actor, really important because it makes me feel ready to play and like I can make choices and have fun with people. And I'm really glad. I think something that lots of the audience members have seen too is that we do have such a good time together. Getting to share this story with them every night, but really having fun and going through all of these things together has been such a blast.
You know, Derek, one of the fun parts as an audience member is when you're a Go-Go's fan, and you know a lot of their music, you're waiting for certain numbers, you're waiting to check them off, and you're waiting to be able to see how it fits in. In some ways, I mean, I guess you can't avoid the comparison with Mamma Mia. I mean, right, it's going to happen,
sure.
Although I don't know that that's a fair comparison because this is really a different kind of vehicle.
I think one of the strengths of this show, Frankie mentioned this a little, is the verse work because it sort of creates this world where even the text and the way everyone is speaking is very heightened. And because of that, music just flows out a little more organically, I think. And I think everyone was actually super surprised, you know, that the majority of the songs just feel like they could live in this world. So, yeah, it's been a lot of fun. And, you know, Mamma Mia is not a bad show to be compared to.
Yeah, I'll take it, right? And Jeremiah, having to do what you do in this show compared to other roles that you've done, you just seem to have so much fun with this. Is this you enjoying this over, say, a dramatic role or something like that?
That's so interesting because I never thought of myself as thriving in a comedic role. And I have this tendency to really want to get to these juicy things and be dramatic, as I think lots of people do. But it was so fun to find the balance between that and to let the comedy come from that natural place of the innocence and naivety. And playing with that has been great. And I also dabble in drag myself, and it's been so fun to play with that as well, to not even just to live in the world of a character, but within that character to go to another world and get to play in what that might be and how he gets to experience being seen through the many different lenses, as I'll say, to not spoil anything. But oh, it's been so much fun, so much fun.
And Frankie, one of the things I love, of course, your wife, the queen in the show, just a little bit taller than you, maybe just a little bit older than you. And again, you play off of it so well. Just a word about that dynamic between king and queen. You do love her, right?
Yes. Liz Norton is a Chicago treasure. It's just the moment we saw the cast list together, we both cocked our heads over like little dogs, and then just both looked at each other like, this makes absolute sense. At no point did it ever feel like, wow, we're playing something that's out of the realm of the show, or it's a gimmick or anything. Is that it's a beautiful, genuine relationship like anything else you would treat. And we did our research, we did our dramaturgy and all the work of it. And Liz and I don't think I've ever fallen for an actress so hard in my life. And, you know, and again, it just speaks to the offstage dynamic, but on stage, it's that you're working with a brilliant actress and you just look her dead in the eyes and you fall in love with each other. And at times she wants to point out how tall she is, and she just gets to have whatever foot she has on me and gets to play with it. So it's we truly fell in love with each other, and I think that's what's magical about this show.
The great thing is that you guys have so much fun on stage. We have fun in the audience. Head Over Heels is playing. It's a GoCandy production, playing a theater wit, which, by the way, it's the it's quality when you just know it's GoCandy. I really feel that way after the shows I've been seeing over the years. It's through August 25th. You will get a huge kick out of watching Jeremiah and Frankie and Derek. Incredible directing by you. Thanks to all of you. Continue to break legs every night. I love the show, and I hope everybody gets over to Theater Wit and checks it out before August 25th. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Well,
thanks so much for having us.
Inside my car, I got pictures, got candy. I'm a lovable man, and I can take you to the nearest star. I'm your vehicle, baby. I'll take you anywhere you wanna go. I'm your vehicle, woman. By now, I'm sure you know that I love you, love you. I need you, yeah. I want you, got to have your child. Great God in heaven, you know I love
you. That is one of the great songs of all time, part of my childhood life story growing up, or maybe my adulthood. And, I don't usually let songs play that long, but the truth is I can't stop listening to it, so I figured, the heck with it, let it keep playing. Because that, of course, one of the classic songs from the very popular group, the Ides of March. They're still together, they still play, and they've got a special anniversary coming up with an album to commemorate it, and I am joined by two of the band members. Couldn't be more honored to say hi again to my friends Jim Peterick and Bob Berglund. Gentlemen, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Paul, good to talk to you. Jim Peterick here.
Good to talk to you, Paul.
And first of all, congratulations to both of you. The Ides of March 55th anniversary album called Play On, it being issued in vinyl as well. I need to get my vinyl record player back to do that. But, hey, so 55th anniversary, most people would think you'd do something at 50. That struck me. Anything special about the fact that it's 55? Jim?
Well, go ahead, Bob. You first.
Other than the fact that people ask us all the time, did you realize that you'd be together this long when you were started out in 1964? Heck, we didn't even know what we were doing the next day, let alone 55 years from now. It just seemed like a great milestone. We celebrated every 5 years, and so 55, and we'll be looking forward to 60.
As well you should. Jim, the song, I mean, the vehicle really put you guys on the map, I mean, among your other hits, but it's so amazing. And I was reading about the story of vehicle. You actually owe it to an ex-girlfriend. I mean, who would ever owe a great song to an ex-girlfriend, except maybe Gary Lewis and the Playboys in the song This Diamond Ring. But other than that,
it gets better than that, because I actually wrote it to win back my girlfriend who had dumped me. I was 17, she was 15, but what did I know? She wanted to date other guys. I wrote this song because she kept asking me for rides to various places like cheerleading practice and modeling school. She was pretty
hot.
Even
after you broke
up,
right?
Well, then we broke up, and she kept asking me for rides. I said to myself, all I am is your vehicle, baby. I mean, this is a true story. And you know what? 47 years later, that girl is still my wife.
Wow. How about that? So I guess you worked it out. It must have been the song that brought her back.
It didn't hurt any, Paul.
And Bob, well,
let's hope the statute of limitations has run out on the 15-year-old girl.
wait a minute. I was 17, Bob. Come on.
Well, she was 15, though. There you go.
Yeah, you're not the one we're worried about, Jim, but it's okay. You're married. It's good. Everything worked out just fine. Hey, Bob, and you guys, you know, people, you know, it's not just that you've been bandmates all these years, but I think it is true, even more so than the other band members, you guys have been the best and closest of friends throughout all these years.
It's pretty remarkable. The whole band, four of us, were in grade school band together. The core four of the band, Larry, Mike, Jim, and myself. There's one picture of the grade school band where Mike is in eighth grade in the band picture as a drummer. Jim's in the front row as a sixth grader with his saxophone, and I'm in the middle with my clarinet as a seventh grader. Pretty remarkable.
I love it. And by the way, Jim, the Ides of March, not the original name of the band, and so tell me the original name, and of course you turned to Shakespeare to get your current name.
Right. Well, we were the Shondells, and we were just about to release our first single, 1966, called You Wouldn't Listen. We're going down the street, the records are pressed, and we hear Dick Biondi say, "Noob," from Tommy James and the Shondells, "Hanky Panky." We go, oh boy. And stop the presses, and just then Bob says, "You know, guys, we need a new name. We're reading Julius Caesar. It says, 'Beware the Ides of March.' That sounds like a cool name." We immediately agreed.
Hey, Bob, how, you know, back in those days, 64, 65, 66, you know, you came from Liverpool if you wanted to make it big. Maybe you came from L.A. How did a bunch of guys from Berwyn actually think they could get themselves on the rock and roll map?
Actually, it was just belief and a little bit of luck and opportunity. And frankly, being naive and not knowing any better, we contacted the various record distributors in Chicago. And actually, Larry's mom made the call that set up an appointment with Mercury Records. And we went, she got us an appointment. We went in, and the guy listened to a song that we had pressed on a 45. And he said, "You guys have some potential. I'm going to introduce you to a manager, producer." And that guy's name was Dutch Wensloth, and he helped produce our first record. So you never know. Sometimes it's just you got to be in the right place, right time. And at that time, WLS and WCFL out of Chicago were both powerhouse AM stations booming across the country. And if you got a single on one of those, you could have a hit, and we did. We were very blessed.
Oh, I used to listen to those all the time. Barney Pipp and Jim Stagg, all those guys that were great. I remember, I think it was CFL at some point, had a thing where if you answered the phone and you said, "Think green," you might win a prize. So, like an idiot, every time my phone rang, I'm answering, "Think green." It was never them, and I never won anything. Jim, you know, when I think of what you guys sound like, I mean, back then, somebody would think you would emulate the Beatles and go for that, but you don't. I mean, when I listen to your sound, I do think of Chicago. There are groups that you know, you strike me as, and I'm sure that they strike, you know, you as, but what made you go in sort of that town as opposed to said of, "Hey, let's tap into the Beatles"?
Well, Paul, we were so darn young. When we started in 64, we didn't know who we were. We were just fans of everything, and actually the first rehearsal we ever had, we were together watching the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. We were originally a Beatles wannabe band. We were the Beatles from Berwyn. We were emulating the Beatles, the Zombies, you know, all the English band, the Kinks. Our first single, Before You Wouldn't Listen, was Like It or Lump It, which sounded like the Kinks. And so that became our original sound, and You Wouldn't Listen was like the Hollies meets Curtis Mayfield. But when we started adding brass, it wasn't to sound like Chicago or Blood, Sweat, and Tears. It was to do the soul songs from Memphis, things like Knock on Wood and Soul Man and James Brown, I Feel Good. Then we heard Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and it changed our lives. Chicago, too, but Blood, Sweat, and Tears were our heroes. And when we went in the studio to cut Vehicle, that magic day in late 69, I got to tell you, I was trying to be David Clayton Thomas. I won't kid you about that.
And you still have the guitar you played on that song, because I, of course, watched the show Collector's Call on MeTV featuring your guitars. Bob, you were in there, and that was great. In fact, I was going to ask you if I could have that guitar. I'm sure you would just give it to me.
I turned down a lot of money from that Stratocaster, so I will never part with it. It'll probably be buried with me.
Is smart. Hey, Bob, you guys, you're still playing, you're still around. Can you share any upcoming shows? Where can people catch you? Because it's still amazing to watch you guys.
Well, we're going to be in Elmwood Park this coming Friday, but I want to alert everybody to the fact we're having a big, huge 55th anniversary show October 26th at the beautiful Genesee Theater in Waukegan with special guests, both of whom appear on our album. Number one, Mark Farner of Grand Funk Railroad fame, their frontman, singer, guitar player. And then Bo Bice, who had a huge hit with Vehicle, another number one hit with our song Vehicle of American Idol, and wound up being lead singer for Blood, Sweat, and Tears currently. So two great guest stars on our 55th anniversary show, October 26th.
Genesee Theater, going to be fantastic. Jim, I just have to clarify, for huge fans of yours, I got to hit this so they don't wonder, because you're also so well-known for the incredible song Eye of the Tiger. But to talk about that, I mean, we have to step away from the Ides of March to explain how that song came about, which you do get credit for.
Right. Well, I love talking about, you know, all of my history, and Survivor was a huge part of my history ever since 1977 to when I left the band in 96. And of course, Eye of the Tiger is the crown jewel of that whole era for me. Although Survivor had many hits, that's the one that will probably outlive me, hopefully. There we go with that thing again. But yeah, I mean, who knew? I mean, when I got that fateful call from Sylvester Stallone on my answer machine back in early 82, hey, yo, Jim, give me a call, it's Sylvester Stallone. I thought somebody was putting me on. But I called him back, and sure enough, he gave a band that really was just starting out, Survivor, a shot at the title. And I got together with Frankie, and we hit it out of the park. And I'm absolutely amazed that song is still around, still making a difference. I'm very blessed.
It's a great song. Did you keep that tape from the machine?
Don't I wish. You never think you're making history at the time, you know.
No, you could put it on eBay. Bob, we're really close to the release date for the album, right? When exactly to come out? When can people get it? How can they get it?
It's on pre-sale right now, but it's officially coming out August 16th, so we're about a week away, and it's going to be available all over the place, including the gigs we have coming up over the next the rest of the year.
The pre-sale is on Amazon, and we're getting a lot of pre-sales on that, both for the double vinyl, which you got to buy a turntable, blow off your Shure cartridge and do it, but also the CD, we're getting a lot of pre-orders. And if you pre-order now, you get a bonus track for free, the original master, at which you just played, a Vehicle. And it'll be on our website, and it'll be at record stores, and there are a few left. TheIdesOfMarch.com for absolutely for sure.
Perfect. Well, it'll be the CD for me. My brother will get the vinyl records, as he is wont to do. I look forward to seeing you. You guys are always on the WGN Morning Show, so that's where I first met you. And I can't wait for you to come back here and perform, and always good to see you. And who knows, a Mike Toomey show, who knows when we'll run into each other. We're all kind of part of that WGN family in that way. And I congratulate you on this incredible accomplishment, 55 years, the new CD and vinyl album called Play On, the anniversary album, incredible. And with your permission, because I think of the song Play On, it has the line, the soundtrack of our lives, which is what, for me, you guys are. We're going to go out playing a little bit of Play On. My guest, Jim Peterick, Bob Berglund, congratulations, guys. I look forward to talking to you on your 100th, or the way you do it, the 105th anniversary.
Thanks for having us on your podcast, dude. Thank you.
All right, check them out. Here's a little bit of Play On.
When the fire of life meets the chill of night, there is magic in the air. When the stars align, we reach out to find someone who can take us there. We are the minstrels that pave the way. is yours forever. When a melody turns to memory, it's the soundtrack of our life. Oh, play on, play on. Let the rhythm of it lift you up. Play on and on. It's an open invitation, sweet intoxication. If music is the wine of love, play on.
I'm a solitary man, playing all alone. I can cheat the deck, and who's to really know? I'm an all-together man, playing a one-man band. I play for no one, no one plays for me.
That is the beautiful song called Solitary Man, almost thematic, the theme song for a show playing now at the Pride Arts Center called Now and Then, through August 11th. And amazing show. I highly recommend it. And joining me now is three folks, two actors, and one guy who not only wrote this show but lived it. And we're going to talk about all that. Dennis Manning is with us. He is the creator of The Story, with a book by Ronnie Larson, who he worked with, but then two of the actors, Carl Herzog, Will Fulginetti. Gentlemen, welcome to all of you. I appreciate your time.
Hey, you. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Hey, good to be here, too. Thank you.
Dennis, let's start with you. This is loosely, I guess, your story, so tell the listeners what this show is about and how it taps into your life.
Sure. So it's I guess you would call it a jukebox musical of sorts, but it's a little different because usually the story's first and the music is kind of chopped into it. But in this case, the music came first, and then it's filled in with a lot of my stories that make up the spine of the book. And that's how that came together about 14 months ago, 2018.
And it's the story of Daniel and Greg over the years, a same-sex couple that stays together for decades. And then, ultimately, I guess we can sort of say this, one of them passes on. And I imagine, Dennis, that is what happened in the real world?
That part did not actually happen. So we took a little liberty on that one. But my partner is still around and alive and kicking. And so he is still, we've been together now for 28 years now, this August that we're in.
Congratulations. He must be upset the first time he saw the show, and said, but he got upset probably the first time he saw that you killed him off, but that's another thing.
So the song, Solitary Man, that's 38 years old this year, so that has been around for a long, long time. So
it's a beautiful song.
That is the bookend for the show, and we kind of move on from there.
It's one of those songs you can't get out of your head, I will tell you that, and I love listening to it, so I wanted to open with it. So, Carl, I have seen you perform. You're one of Chicago's great actors, so you step into this role. Talk a little bit about the structure and how we see Daniel and Greg over the years.
Well, it starts linear. It starts with the younger version and how they meet and their relationship and the lovey-dovey, and then... Maybe a third through the first act, you get your first look at we just call it Greg and Daniel 2, so the middle-aged version, which I play Daniel 2, Dennis's middle-aged version, the singer-songwriter, and they're definitely on the rock. They come in and they sing Good Morning, but it's sort of a sarcastic Good Morning. They are not having a good morning or a good life together. They're upset. We find that they're sort of unbalanced, where one person has given up their dreams of being a comedian to support the other, and neither dream is really coming to fruition. And so it sort of deals with that artist versus survival job. And then you see the older version come in pretty much right after that. But it breaks up. It's nonlinear after that. We jump back and forth, and sometimes we support each other. There's a portion where all three Daniels are on stage together talking and trying to get Daniel 2 to get his life together so that we can have that future.
And Will, you're the youngin' in this group, and playing Daniel in the early days. And you're a fascinating person to watch because, first of all, you're sort of, I don't know if you still live in New York. I know you're out of New York in terms of your studies, but you come into this, and we sort of see the character of Daniel go through some modifications because at the beginning, you're not quite sure about your identity. Talk about Daniel in his younger days.
That's right. Yeah, so he comes into the scene. The way that we've approached the beginning is that he has played at, say, a few open mics before, but the first time you see him play Solitary Man in the very beginning, he is more or less just starting into this new career of his and this mindset of being famous and a huge future he has, and all he really needs is, like, a little bit of encouragement, and it happens to be through a romantic exchange with Greg One, the youngest version of Greg, who seems like to magically charm him and make him understand more about himself that he hadn't prior to his studies in the seminary, that he said he was going to try to be a priest and moved on to songwriting.
And by the way, Dennis, I'm sort of curious because as we see Greg and Daniel as they first meet, Greg is he's a comedian, but he's pretty sarcastic. I'm a little surprised at first that maybe Daniel is interested in him because of all the sarcasm and some of the funny insults. I get the humor. But I'm just curious, Dennis, was that a sign of reality as well, or was that a creation for your partner you just kind of created or a characteristic you created?
No, I would say that's also part of it. My partner is funny. You know, not all jokes land, but, you know, he likes to definitely give a different look at things. So, and Greg doesn't want to be sarcastic, but he really thinks he's funny. And not all his jokes kind of land or fly where we'd like them to. So I think maybe that's part of his frustration as it showed us on, is that he used to be funny. So that's where that goes.
I'm going to stay with you on this, Dennis. You know, this show will be going on in the West End. You're not always in this show. What is it like as the guy that essentially wrote this story, created this story, watching other people play you and play your partner through the years? I mean, and then we'll find out from Carl how it is to have that watch. But what's it like watching people play your lives out?
Well, it's heartfelt. It's humbling. It's a lot of angst. You know, when you see it played out again and again, it's still, you know, different things grab me different nights, and you know, I think it's just an honor to watch these guys tear it up and bring the matter to it, you know, in such dramatic ways than I ever thought could happen. You know, this music would never have been heard, and now it's being heard by, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people throughout the run here. So it's a wonderful thing for me to be here.
And Carl, any pressure on you? Listen, you do a lot of shows. You've been directed by a lot of people and all that. But now here, the guy whose life this is that you're playing is watching you. I'm just curious: is that you're an actor, so you don't care, or is there a little extra pressure that comes with that?
No pressure at all. Only because Dennis Manning is one of the most humble people I've ever met, and the script is also very, very easy to follow and understand. And from the get-go, Dennis has been very liberal and letting me kind of play with it and do what I want. And he's been very generous with his praise as far as the choices that I've made with the script and what I've been doing. So and I love Chicago. I love Chicago theater. I love new work. So it's something I'm very passionate about to begin with. So no pressure. Just the opposite, really. Just it's been a very joyful experience for me working on this new work and just putting my thumbprint on his life, I guess. It's been a unique pleasure, I think.
And Will, you know, there has to be a consistency. People change over the years, but you know, look, I've lived the decades in the past. I'm sort of curious: how cognizant are you of watching the Daniels who go into their 30s, into their 40s, in the later versions of you? Are you cognizant of the fact that you've got to do something consistent with the way Daniel looks later, if that question makes sense?
I think I understand what you're saying. Yeah, it's funny because this show has been, in a lot of ways, like Carl just explained, like a great cause of inspiration and just kind of like overview of the things that I consider important in my life now, and how, yes, exactly, things totally change, and how it's taught me more or less to embrace the fact that will occur in my life, and Dennis has been as an amazingly humble person, as Carl explained so well, such an empowering force in my life, continuing like all of what I want to do, and musically, it's been an honor to be able to play his music every single night I get to. and that it'll be with me as I continue through my journey.
Yeah, that is true. You guys actually have to play the guitar. So you are you a guitarist? I mean, you didn't learn that for this show? Is that one of the skills you said, hey, I've got it?
Oh yeah, I've been playing guitar since I was about like eight years old, and I took this on knowing that I would try like just my absolute hardest and practice these songs and mail them for Dennis to make sure that they were up to his standards.
Well, let's find out, Dennis. Dennis, Will, and Carl, they up to your standards? Let's check it out. There you go.
Yeah, even more than I could imagine. Both of these two gentlemen have brought such a different, their own style into what was what is my music, but they have made it their own and bring out things. I have goosebumps now that I never, you know, maybe heard in my head, but never thought I could ever bring out. But you know, Will's take on Solitary Man and Red Rose, he just makes all that his own flair. And what Carl did with Falling Over Day is, you know, he went back and just really reimagined that whole song for us, among other things. So they do an amazing job.
Well, I congratulate all of you. You can go get tickets at nowandthenmusical.com. That's where the tickets are. It is playing over at the Pride Arts Center up on North Broadway in the city. It's there through August 11th. It's an intimate show. What's really nice is you guys are generally, I mean, I know for you for sure, Dennis, you kind of go out in the lobby afterwards and say hi to people who have come to see it, and let them get to meet you. You did it when I was there. I assume you do it maybe every night. I hope so.
Yeah. For sure.
And that's so important. Carl, will you as well? So congratulations to you. Again, Solitary Man is a song that just sticks in my head. So I should either love you or hate you for that. I'm not sure which, but I think I love you for that. It's a great song. Dennis Manning, Carl Herzog, Will Falgianetti, congratulations. Don't miss Now and Then, Pride Arts Center through August 11th. Check it out, nowandthenmusical.com. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate you.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you.
Take care.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes and tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.